begin describing how to compute string theory amplitudes. So string theory scattering amplitudes. In order to motivate the structures I will introduce, I will first discuss the same problem in quantum field theory. So I will move backwards, I will start from standard Feynman diagrams in quantum field theory and try to recast them in a way that makes the analogy to string theory more manifest. It makes it easier to generalize from particles to strings. So my objective, actually, perhaps I should first ask if there are questions about last lecture, although we didn't really do any calculations. So
I have one question.
Yes?
So did you say that the bosonic string theory was like an unstable, potentially an unstable vacuum that might decay into something that makes sense?
Potentially. It's not quite clear. I think at some point people described domain walls between bosonic string and superstring, for example, which is not clear to me if this implies that the bosonic string could decay to superstrings.
The bosonic string it's inconsistent because it's not.
It has a tachyon.
Has a what?
It has a tachyon.
Okay.
So there is one scalar field which has a potential which is unbounded from below. And so the theory will fall down, the potential. And it's not clear what's at the end of it. Mm-hmm.
Can a D-brain be any dimension?
Sorry?
Can a D-brain be any dimension?
Yes. Well, in bosonic string, yes. So you could have a D0, D1, D2, D3. Now, in bosonic string, all of these D-brains have also tachyons on their world volume, which means all of these D-brains are also unstable. So the theory itself is unstable, and we don't know where it goes. The D-brains are unstable, but we know where they go. So they just decay to nothing. In the superstring, the theory will be stable, and the D-brains, some of the D-brains will be stable, because they carry charges, which are not carried by fundamental strings, so they cannot disappear.
You said the D-brain was the endpoint of the string, but the endpoint of the string in time is always...
No, a D-brain is a rule
yeah.
on how endpoints, on which endpoints are allowed.
Okay.
So it's not the endpoint of the string.
I see.
It's the place where the endpoint lives. You could say, if you said that the open string can only end on here, on this object, this will be a D-brain. If it says that it can end wherever it wants in space-time, you have a space-filling D-brain. Okay, so my objective is to take a standard scattering amplitude in quantum field theory associated to some Feynman diagram, like the one at the last time. And rewrite it in the following manner. I wanted to write it as an integral over some finite dimensional moduli space of intrinsic geometry of the diagram. Sort of an integral over the possible lengths of the segments, for example. And a path integral over all possible ways of embedding the diagram space-time. With some action.
You will get what is LAB?
Hmm?
I don't get what is LAB.
I will explain, okay. But for now, they're intrinsic lengths of the edges of the graph. So I want to write the Feynman diagram as an integral over the possible proper lengths of the segments, and an integral over the maps from the graph into space-time with some action which depends on the embedding and on the lengths. So let me introduce some notation that will be useful. So let me just denote with some numbers internal or other external legs or interaction vertices. Let me denote the momenta that flow along vertices, along edges. This way, so for example, here I'll have a momentum P14, say. And here I'll have a momentum P45. I will denote the lengths of edges in the same way. So when I say L45, I will denote the length of this edge. But we'll see momentarily what that means. So for now, let me just use this piece of notation. And then standard Farman diagram for a... Now, let me, for simplicity, let me focus on a scalar field theory. Okay, so all my particles will be scalars with some masses. It's possible to generalize this to fermions or gauge bosons if needed. So how do you write a Farman diagram? Well, you integrate over the internal momenta. Does this make sense? So for each edge, I have a propagator. And for each interaction vertex, I have a momentum conservation. Now, the first step of the manipulation would be to write the propagators in a proper time formalism. Pretty simple formula. Is this clear? If I integrate in L, I just get 1 over the exponent from 0 to infinity. Now, when I do this substitution, now the integral of the momenta is Gaussian. I can just execute it. So sorry, before I do that, I want to also rewrite the delta functions. This way. Oh, I'm omitting also the factors of 2 pi and i's and all of that. It's not really important for now. So I can also do something like this. now the integral of the momentum is Gaussian. I'm going to use this formula. Get this intermediate expression, which is just the Feynman diagram computed in position space. So, as I said, this is just the computation done in position space. I'm integrating over the position of the interaction vertices. This is literally what you would get if you just took your path integral and pulled down a bunch of interaction Lagrangians. You'd be left with the integral of the interaction vertices, some wave functions for the external particles, and then the propagators from corresponding to each edge, the two-point functions of fields for each edge. So this just comes from the weak contractions. So in particular, this is just the Green's function of the scalar field theory. So now the next step, and unfortunately I was supposed to use first the black hole under. Yeah, well, the next step is to manipulate this expression a bit further. So I want to really interpret this as the amplitude for a particle to propagate from a point of space-time to another point of space-time. Notice this looks a bit like the Green function of a Schrodinger equation. That analogy will be useful. So in order to proceed, let me discuss the quantization of a relativistic particle. First, are there any questions about these manipulations? I'm not sure if you've already seen Feynman diagrams in position space, but they're straightforward. Just a Fourier transform. This is a bit more interesting. But, so classically, how do you describe a relativistic particle? What's the action? Anybody?
Proper time.
Hmm?
The proper time.
Yes, the proper length. That's right. So, the action associated with some trajectory is the total length of the trajectory, which you can write by introducing some parametrization in the following form. So this is a standard expression for the length of a trajectory in space-time, in flat space. Now, how do we quantize this? This is not a great looking action. It's not polynomial. It's hard to deal with it. Also, it has an interesting feature, which this parameter was a completely arbitrary choice. There is no intrinsic way to parameterize the trajectory. So I could have just done any coordinate redefinition, right, and transformed, and this action would be invariant. So a path integral over all functions x of u would not be great, because it would overcount the choice of parameterization, precisely as it happens in gauge theory. This is a gauge symmetry of an unusual type. And so to define a good path integral, you would like to just subtract off the contribution from this gauge symmetry. So to divide by the volume of the group of such transformations. So these are called diffeomorphisms. So I'll denote what we're trying to do as a path integral over the axis modulo diffeomorphism with this action. So in order to make sense of something like that, there is a useful trick, which is to introduce an extra degree of freedom, which allow you to manipulate this in a better form. So let me consider another action, which is polynomial in the axis. Come on, this block will stop working too. No, I don't think it would work. Oh, maybe it will stay. Okay, so is this probably not visible, right?
Let me just
go here. Now you can check that if you, so E enters just as a sort of Lagrangian multiplier, it has no dynamics, no derivatives, there are no derivatives in E. If you integrate E away, you go back to this. But at least this is polynomial in X. Of course, it's not polynomial in E, so we're not still not in a good place. Notice that this action still has the gauge symmetry, it's just a little bit more hidden, meaning that you, as you transform U, you also need to transform E. So E behaves like a one-dimensional Wilbein, or if you want, E squared behaves like a metric. On the word line. So now we're going to try to define the path integral over U, over X, sorry, and E, modulo diffeomorphisms. Now the final trick is that there is one degree of freedom in E, and we have one degree of freedom worth of gauge redefinitions. So we can sort of use gauge freedom to gauge fix E. and get rid of it. Now we can get rid of almost all of E, but not quite everything, because the total length computed with this metric of the word, of the word line is gauge invariant. So this whole field has only one piece of information, which is gauge invariant, which is the total length. So so I can gauge fix, I can trade the integral over E. I can cancel out the integral over E against the diffeomorphisms and just be left with an integral over the length, finite dimension, over, you know, 1 degree of freedom. Now, to do this properly, really, we should have used all sort of complicated technology of quantizing constrained systems, or quantizing systems with gauge symmetry, called BRST formalism. We'll do so in a later lecture, but for now, let me just do things a bit by hand. So really, you should have checked that somehow this measure contributes the same volume as the volume of diffeomorphisms. But in this, I'll just assume it for now. In principle, you could have, this ratio could have left you behind some complicated function of the length. But it didn't. So after I gauge fix, my action takes a nice form. So now the action is quadratic and nice. It's a sort of one-dimensional problem. So are there any questions about these manipulations?
Why do we want to get rid of the gauge symmetry again?
Oh, I must want to get rid of E because there is an E inverse. And I don't know how to quantize actions which are not polynomial. And it just so happened that I can treat most of E as a gauge freedom. I mean, I can use my gauge freedom to fix E to some form, like say E is constant. Equal to 1, you know, equal to L. And then integral from 0 to 1 of this constant is L. So when you study electromagnetism, you can also trade some gauge symmetry for some degrees of freedom. For example, you can go to axial gauge and kill one of the components of the gauge field. Usually you don't want to do that because it ruins some symmetry, makes Lorentz invariant not manifest in gauge theory. Here we were lucky and we could get rid of this gauge transformation without breaking any of the structure of the theory. This path integral can be done immediately. And if your path integral starts from xA and ends in xB, you get this right away. So it's an exercise I leave for home. If I do a path integral like this, I end up here. It's straightforward. If you can just look for the classical solution that has specific boundary conditions. Write x as classical solution plus fluctuations. This is just a classical action. And the fluctuations just give you an overall constant. OK, so this is the end of the motivational part of the lecture. So I want to do the same thing for string theory, for strings. So my aim is to write down an amplitude for string theory which will be associated to some topology for my worksheet, and which is written as a finite dimensional integral over a modulized space of intrinsic geometries of the worksheet, and a path integral of all possible ways of embedding my surface into space-time. And my objective is to get to an action which is as simple as this, something that I can easily quantize. Any questions about the quantum field theory before we go to string theory? I mean, the quantization of the relativistic particle is a wonderful exercise. And when we do, when we look at BRST quantization, you might want to try to apply the technology to this example. So, what could the action for a string be? Suppose I want to repeat the whole story for strings. So, I need some analog of this action. Any suggestions? Precisely. So I put some constant here, which I'll ignore later, and just stick the area. Now, the area of a worksheet embedded in space-time, put capital X to distinguish it from the particle, takes this form. So what have I done? First of all, I introduced some local coordinates on the worksheet, the same way as I introduced some local coordinates along the word line. So I call them U1 and U2. I typically will not be able to do so on the whole worksheet. There will be many different patches, and I'll have an expression like this in each patch. And this makes sense. Now, this thing inside the square root is obtained this way. You take the Jacobian, you know, the derivative of the position with respect to these coordinates. You contract the indices for the position, so you get a 2x2 matrix. Take the determinant of this matrix. So this is, what is this? This is just the induced matrix, right? If you're done, when you're done relativity, you assume, you might have seen, that if you have some submanifold embedded in the manifold, you get a metric on the submanifold induced from the ambient space. Like if I take this piece of paper in flat space, I get a metric on this piece of paper. This metric is just the expression for the metric is just a variant of the expression for how the metric changes under the homomorphism, right? So the new metric is, I should have probably written partial derivatives here, sorry, is obtained by contracting the Jacobian with the old metric. With the ambient metric, sorry. And here I just use the flat space metric. Mm-hmm.
Could there be a sign problem when you're working Minkowski versus Euclidean?
Sure. I will not worry about that for now, but you could worry about that. So let me assume for now that the worksheet is Euclidean. Somehow it's embedded in space-time in the way that makes it Euclidean. But you're right that in principle, you know, when I look at something like this, this worksheet is definitely not embedded in a Euclidean way. This cylinder is moving in time. So if I put back the metric, I'll find something which is actually Lorentzian. I will momentarily rewrite this in a way that makes the sign less important. But this is a subtlety which is hidden in here and will be hidden in a discussion. I will ignore it, but it's not unimportant. So in quantum field theory, there is this whole matter of I epsilon prescriptions that you need to use to make sense of Lorentzian quantum field theory amplitudes, which tell you exactly how your, you know, all the integrals you write are realistically contour integrals, slightly deformed in the complex plane in ways that make things sensible and unitary. So in similarly, all the integrals we'll encounter later on in string theory have to be appropriately analytically continued in certain ways, which are equivalent to this epsilon prescription. Okay, keep in mind that there is an interesting subtlety here, but let me ignore it for now. Later on in later lectures, whenever we hit that subtlety again, I will mention it. Explain a bit of it. So this is the definition of the induced metric for a surface or any other object. It's completely analogous to how we computed the length. So to compute the area, you take the induced metric and you just take the usual measure, square root of the determinant of the metric on the surface, integrated in local coordinates. Now, this expression is invariant under a parametrization because if I change my coordinates from u to u primes, just write it like that, then my Jacobian then this partial derivative is changed by the Jacobian of the coordinate transformation. When I take the determinant, I get a determinant of this for this factor, another determinant for this factor. So the determinant goes out, and it cancels the determinant that appears from the coordinate transformation. So again, this is an exercise you can check. So this is called the Nambu-Goto action. It's not something you can quantize as it is. So we need to do manipulations analogous to those. And it turns out that manipulations are strictly analogous. So here we introduce the metric as an auxiliary variable, and things improved. So in the same way, we can consider an action which depends on the choice of metric on the surface. Now notice that when you extremize this action with respect to the metric, the extremum condition is essentially that E square is equal to the induced metric. So similarly, I'm going to write an action with the property that if you extremize it with respect to the auxiliary metric, the auxiliary metric becomes equal to the induced metric. So this is called the Polyakov action. So just a bit of notation. With H, I denoted the determinant of HAB. So this is the same notation seen in general relativity. And HAB is the inverse metric. So again, this is definitely not polynomial in the metric. The square root, there is an inverse. But at least it's polynomial in the axis. And of course, the form of Friesian invariance is still there. As you do a coordinate transformation in the U's, you just need to transform H in the obvious way by Jacobians so that this expression is invariant. So let me just write explicitly, right? Now, can we repeat the same trick as we did there? Can we use the form of Friesian invariance to get rid of this metric so that we can define the path integral Now, the answer is no. Unfortunately, there are 2 degrees of freedom in your changes of coordinates, but the 2D metric has 3 degrees of freedom. So what can we do? One thing you can do is to reduce the metric to a single degree of freedom, locally at least. So locally, I can pick a gauge where HAB is proportional to a flat metric. The fact you can do that is some old theorem in geometry whose name I forget. Now, once you do this, you can plug it in here and see if some simplifications occur. And actually, a lot of simplifications occur. You'll notice that phi disappears. So, see, the determinant of H is a factor of e to the 2 phi. Take the square root, becomes an e to the phi. The inverse of H has an e to the minus phi. So the phi is canceled. So if you use this gauge, the action just reduces to the action on a flat worksheet. So what's going on? The fact that the action does not depend on a whole degree of freedom means there was a symmetry we didn't notice. Indeed, the cancellation of phi would have occurred for any other metric I put here. So there is just a new symmetry. So there was diffeomorphisms. And there is another symmetry called Weyl symmetry, which takes the metric and rescales it without doing anything else to the coordinates. So if Weyl symmetry is really a symmetry of the problem and the action does not depend on it, we should treat it as a gauge symmetry. Otherwise, we'll have this big factor here of volume of the Weyl group, which would not do anything useful. Now, there are some, quantum mechanically, there are some problems with Weyl symmetry. There are some obstructions in having a a path integral with a measure which is invariant while symmetric. And I'll discuss that at the end of the lecture. For now, let's pretend that there is no problem, so that you can really try to define a path integral which has diffeomorphisms n while as a gauge symmetry. Now we definitely have enough degrees of freedom to kill the metric, because we bring it locally at least. We bring it to this form, and then we do a wild transformation, and it becomes flat. So we can take our worksheet and cover it in flat patches. And each flat patch will have a nice quadratic action, which you can easily quantize. Now, there is something I should have mentioned already in the relativistic particle, and I forgot. I'm sorry. So when I said that I can just gauge fix the metric and forget about it, I should have been a bit more careful. If you remember when you gauge fix things in electrodynamics, you can gauge fix, but you cannot forget about gauge symmetry completely, in the sense that the equations of motion for the fields that you have gauge fixed away have to still be imposed on your field configurations. Again, we will understand this a bit better perhaps in the BRST formalism, but for now it's just a general statement that I'll leave there. So in this case, the equations of motion told you that E was the induced metric. But we said that in this gauge, E is constant. So the induced metric should be constant. If you look at it, if you stare at it, you know, in practice, what it means is that you get an extra constraint. Which you need to impose on your solutions. So let me say it properly. If you study solutions of this, you know, classical solutions to this action, modulo gauge transformations, there's the same way as studying solutions of this action, but with this constraint. So you had a nonlinear problem here. It looked like we transformed it into a linear problem. It's almost true, but it's a linear problem with the quadratic constraint. Now, this is called constraint because once you impose it on your initial conditions, and this is something you impose on the velocity at some point, it remains true at all subsequent times. So it's not an extra equation of motion. It's just telling you when you study the solution, study solutions which start in a specific way. The solution of the linear problem with a quadratic constraint on the initial conditions. Right, this is telling you the particle is on shell. The momentum squared equals the mass squared. In a similar way, when you compare solutions of this nonlinear problem to solutions of this linear problem, you have to impose a constraint on the initial conditions. The constraint is the equation of motion for the auxiliary metric. So it takes the form del S over del HB equal to zero. Now, the variation of the action with respect to the metric is called the stress tensor. So it's some quadratic expression of the axis, which we'll write down in the next lecture. So even before we worry about quantization, we've done something entertaining. We took this problem, which is find minimal area or extremal area surfaces in flat space. It's a highly nonlinear problem. We convert it into a linear problem, solve a bunch of Laplacian equations, one for each coordinate. The equation of motion for these are just Laplacian of x on the surface equal to zero for each x individually. The different coordinates don't even talk to each other. But in order to find extremal surfaces, you need to still impose this quadratic constraint on the initial conditions. Yes.
Why can't we just say HAB is locally equal to delta AB? Because it's a manifold, so it's local. But why do we need this while property of symmetry to remove?
Oh, the matrix on the manifold is not locally flat. So take general relativity. So how many components are there in the matrix? There are 10 components in the matrix in four dimensions, and you only have four diffeomorphisms. You cannot put all the components of the matrix to be zero, to be. I mean, see, space, the curvature of space-time is an intrinsic notion. So clearly you cannot make space-time flat by just a coordinate transformation. A metric of this form is still curved. For example, if I take this blackboard and I say that I put this conformal factor, variable conformal factor, the blackboard will have a bumpy metric. While transformations can eliminate the curvature, though, at least locally. So can really make it flat. Now, they can make it flat locally, but not globally. If you have a ball, hopefully you cannot make the ball flat globally, right? So it must be true that these manipulations can only be done in patches. So this is important in trying to understand what are the gauge invariant quantities. See, here, it was easy to find the gauge invariant quantity. The total length of the line was the gauge invariant quantity. What do we do here? The area definitely is not a gauge invariant quantity, because wild transformations are going to change the area. Locally, there is no gauge invariant quantities. So what sort of global properties of the worksheet can be gauge invariant? The what, sorry?
Topological properties.
Topological properties, that's true. Okay, so if that was the case, there would be just a discrete set of choices. Is my surface a donut or a sphere? But there's actually a little bit more. So, well, a lot more. So suppose I do this exercise. I take a hole, I cover my surface with patches. And in each patch, I put a conformally flat metric. What are the coordinate transformations? Which coordinate transformations leave a metric in this form? Conformal transformations, that's right. So transformations which send the metric back to itself up to its scaling. Infinitesimally, these are controlled by something called conformal killing vectors. Now, in Chilean, the set of conformal transformations in dimension bigger than 2 is pretty small. There's a finite group of conformal transformations of flat space. In the same way, there is a finite group of translations or rotations of the flat space. But in 2 dimensions, it's a bit special. There is an infinite dimensional collection of conformal transformations. So more precisely, suppose that I use complex coordinates. So I can write my metric in this form. Suppose I do a coordinate transformation, but I want to leave it to the, in this form. So I should not have any desi squared or any desi bar squared. It's easy to see that this can happen only in 2 ways. And actually, if you want to be continuously connected to the identity, only in 1 way, which is that these transformations coordinates are holomorphic. So when you expand your dz into dz prime and dz bar prime, you don't want this piece. So conformal transformations are holomorphic coordinate transformations. So when you do that, clearly phi e to the phi shifts by the absolute value squared of this quantity. So what do we have here? We have this atlas with collection of patches with holomorphic coordinates in each patch and holomorphic coordinate transformations between patches. This structure has a name. It's called the complex structure. It makes your two-dimensional real manifold into a complex manifold. So this is the totality of the gauge invariant information hidden in this matrix, a complex structure. So matrix modulo diffeomorphisms and while is the same as complex structures. And it just so happened that if you give me a Riemann surface with given topology, there is a finite dimensional, but rather non-trivial, space of possible complex structures on that Riemann surface. Sorry, not the surface. A surface equipped with a complex structure is called the Riemann surface. So now we go to something of this form. We'll have to do an integral over the space of Riemann surfaces of an Eppat integral over all possible ways of embedding this Riemann surface in space-time using an action, which is this nice quadratic action. So the problem has been broken down in two parts. The first is a free quantum field theory calculations in two dimensions. So I have this quantum field theory with one scalar field for each dimension of space-time. I'll do some calculation in the quantum field theory in two dimensions, and then I will integrate it over the modular space of complex structures. And the result will be the string theory amplitude. So we're a little short of time, so I'm not sure I will discuss more about the modular space of complex structure. Tomorrow I'll probably do so. Instead, I would like to go back to the problem of wild symmetry. So is wild symmetry really a symmetry of the quantum mechanical theory? So what can go wrong? So whenever we define a path integral, a measure in a path integral, we need to do some sort of regularization because it's difficult to work with infinitely many degrees of freedom. Typically, you try to sort of discretize your space-time a little bit or throw away some Fourier modes or something like that, put a cutoff, regularize in some way. And then you try to remove the cutoff, but in the process, you might ruin some symmetries. So it's possible that some symmetries are broken by the cutoff and cannot be recovered as the cutoff is removed. Now, why should I believe that diffeomorphism invariance remains a symmetry? Well, when I define my cutoff, I could define the cutoff in a way that uses the metric itself in a coordinate independent way. For example, I could say I want to throw away all the, when I try to say something like throw away all the Fourier modes below a certain value, I could do it by that. I could take the Laplacian on the surface defined with the auxiliary metric. And I could say, OK, let's throw away all the modes of x whose Laplacian is larger than a certain value. This definition it's coordinate independent and kind of demonstrates that the diffeomorphism can be preserved as a symmetry. Now, the problem is that there is no such trick is possible with wild symmetry. The wild symmetry really changes the scale, right? It can take something very small and make it very large. It's very hard to think of a cutoff which would be wild invariant, wild covariant. If I say I want to throw away all the short distance physics, well, I can't because I don't know how to define short distance in a world that is wild invariant. So it's almost automatic that you will break wild invariant as you introduce a cutoff. And now you can try to figure out if you can recover it. Now, the question, can I recover a symmetry? It's often of topological nature. So what does it mean that you ruin a symmetry? It means that when you do a symmetry transformation, your measure is not invariant, but changes by some amount. Now, what you could do is to add to the action some term which cancels this, so that you recover your symmetry. So the problem is the following sort. Which sort of variations could possibly occur in the path integral, in the measure, which cannot be cancelled by the variation of the term in the action? So it's a sort of a cohomological problem, actually. So you try to write down all sorts of local functionals of your gauge transformation and of your fields, which could be describing what's going wrong. And you try to write down all the local functional of your fields. And you check, if I do variation, gauge transformation of these local functionals, which local functionals do I get? Do I miss any? And often the difference is, even if there are infinitely many functionals you can write, the difference is finite. So there is a finite list of gauge failures of gauge symmetry which cannot be cured. So because these are finite dimensional and they're also often topological in nature, meaning that if you do continuous transformations of your theory, you cannot eliminate an anomaly that was there, a problem that was there, or you cannot introduce it if it was not there to start with. So in this particular situation of wild symmetry in two dimensions, there is only one functional which can pop out of a gauge transformation and which cannot be cured. So the anomaly is controlled by one number, the coefficient in front of this. It's either there or not. And each theory contributes some number, some amount to the number. Each term in your path integral contributes a certain amount to that number. The number is called the central charge. We will see that each or the X fields contributes one to the number, and the path integral over the metric contributes minus 26. So as a consequence, this only makes sense if there are 26 X's. So this type of bosonic string makes sense only if it's moving in 26 dimensions, or if there is some other field added on the worksheet which can similarly cancel the 26, minus 26. So one way to cancel things is to make the string moving in 26 flat directions. There are other possibilities, but sort of the amount of degrees of freedom on the worksheet is fixed. So this is called the critical dimensional string theory. Different types of string theories will have different critical dimensions. If you do not have that dimension, that critical dimension, so what happens is that while transformation is not a symmetry, what happens is that when you plug this metric into the system, phi does not appear in the classical action, but it pops out as the variation of the integral or the measure. So your action will be this action plus some function of phi. And phi will behave like just another field on your worksheet. So these non-critical string theories are ultimately critical string theories in disguise, where there is one extra coordinate coordinate which behaves in some silly way. So we will not discuss non-critical strings in the rest of the course. Okay, so next time we'll discuss maybe a little bit of. Actually, I'll probably leave the model espresso complex structures for later on. So next lecture we'll focus on this theory. So on doing this part of the calculation.
Very good to start using these 2D CFTs, the complex structures to arrive to these 8 dimensions.
Sorry,
this is start using the power of 2D CFTs to arrive to these
I don't know where.
26 physical dimensions.
Possibly.
I heard that before.
I'm not sure what the story is.
From 2D CFTs, they use like other methods to get to the physical
dimensions. No, right. Right, so it's worth saying, anomalies can manifest themselves in many different ways. So if you want to keep, while the Fermor is invariant, and you want to keep Lorentz symmetry in space-time, then they pop out as the central charge.
I heard there's a very more painful and more hand-wavy way of killing these conformal anomalies.
Yes, so you can sacrifice Lorentz invariance in space-time and hide the anomaly there. That's called the light cone gauge. Then, so the problem somehow it's anomalies are squeezable. You can push them around and move them in different places, but they don't disappear.